With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Kieran Goddard about his novel Hourglass. Kieran grew up in Birmingham in a working-class family and is an acclaimed published poet. Kieran also speaks internationally on issues related to social change and develops research on several areas related to work and workers' rights. In this episode, we talk about specificity when writing universal themes, Kieran's writing routine, which involves checking in to grotty hotels, and how an obsession with pop music led him to writing. But first, here's Kieran with an extract from Hourglass.
We have neighbours now who don't really talk to us, and they both wear gilets regularly. When I tell you that this strikes me as an important piece of information, you disagree, but I persist. Gilets have no sleeves. Where would you even wear your heart? Gilets are an aesthetic abomination and an affront to God. Art thanks existence by honouring that which prefigures utopia. You know this. We've spoken about it. We agreed on it. In what possible way do gilets prefigure utopia? Why are you always siding with them? The neighbours who wear gilets have a picture of Noah's Ark in their front window. I presume it was drawn by their child, who also wears gilets sometimes. The drawing has three thick wavy blue lines denoting the sea. A brown boat that is a perfect half circle, a thin orange animal that I take to be a giraffe, and a big rainbow that has so many colours that they have started to blend into one another like an old bruise. That drawing always makes me feel strange. One night, I tell you that I think it makes me feel strange because there are no dead animal bodies floating about in the water. If Noah only took two of each animal, then surely the flood would have killed the rest of them. By rights, any drawing of Noah's Ark should show the sea full of dead animal carcasses, hundreds of floating emu rib cages, thousands of hippo jaws, and so on, right? So I think the drawing makes me feel strange because it reminds me of death and all the ways that we hide it. But you disagree. You tell me that the drawing makes you think about how nice it might be to have a child, one who draws boats as half circles and gets too excited with the colours when they're drawing a rainbow. Something new takes root in me when you say that, and I can feel it spreading through my forearms.
Hi, Kieran. Thanks for joining me on the podcast today. I'm really looking forward to talking about your new novel, Hourglass, with you.
Great. Thanks, Chloe. Thanks for having me.
So can you start us off by explaining what Hourglass is about?
I've gotten into this habit, as one does, I suppose, of describing Hourglass as just a love story. And I tend to say, it's a love story, like classic love story. Boy meets girl, boy loses mind. But there are some other things going on there. The boy also loses God. The boy also loses his sense of rootedness, his sense of position in the sort of socioeconomic and class context. He also loses some strange thing like his toenails. you know, throughout the rest of the book. But it's a book about a love and losing what you love, and how one kind of tries to do that in a, you know, I suppose a spiritually dignified way.
Yeah, so you've mentioned that the novel is a love story essentially at its heart, and it's very much the lifespan of a love story, kind of from the early days of meeting the person, asking all these questions about each other, and then to the painful aftermath when it ends. Can you speak about how that idea came to life for you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there is probably two aspects of that come together. And the first is, at risk of giving an incredibly Ron-seal answer to this, I was actually looking at an hourglass, of all things, and it got me thinking about what an unusual object an hourglass is. So if we compare it to a standard clock, which shows us the present moment, or at least like a representation of the present moment numerically, the hourglass does something completely different, right? It shows you the past. It shows you all the sand that has fallen through the hourglass. And it also shows you the future. It shows you all of the sand that's yet to fall through the hourglass. Whereas the present, which is of course the only moment we live in, is reduced to this tiny infinitesimal kind of miniature bit in the middle. And I thought, firstly, that's strange. Why has that never occurred to me before, what a kind of complex object an hourglass is? And secondly, what would it look like if I expanded that middle section and I made all three, past, present and future, if I gave them kind of equal importance? And when I started to think about that, I thought that perhaps the state of being that distorts our relationship to time most profoundly is being in love. So those were the two ideas I had in mind, really, to trace the sort of, yeah, the past, the present and the future of a love story, but to really focus in on the way that it kind of distorts time and subjectivity. So there are moments in the book where a few seconds last pages and pages, for example, and also moments where entire, what might even be years, seem to pass, incredibly quickly. So those were the kind of ideas I was playing around with.
So you're primarily known as a poet, and you've obviously had poetry published, and the form of hourglass has a poetic feel to it. So I was wondering whether you always knew it was going to become a novel, whether you kind of set out to write something in longer form, or did it start life as a poem itself?
It was always a novel, but the relationship between, you know, hourglass and my poetry is there is one, you know, absolutely. My poems tend to be incredibly short, kind of often less than sort of 30 words even. So the idea of writing a long poem has never occurred, never occurred to me. And I'd written novels previously. They just weren't, in my view, good enough. Mm. So they never kind of saw the light of day. In terms of the sort of poetic form of Hourglass, there's definitely an attention to the individual line, the rhythm of a line, a kind of density of symbolism that does give it a poetic feel, which isn't to say that those things don't exist in prose. Of course they do. It's just, I suppose, it's where they sit in the hierarchy, you know, of importance. And perhaps in Hourglass they sit slightly nearer the top, rather than, let's say, pace or plot that might ordinarily sit there. I think there is a relationship, and there's a kind of architecture to the book that perhaps has a concordance with poetry as well. So the book is three sections, each of which has an identical amount of subsections, which more or less have an identical amount of words in them. So there is a kind of linguistic symmetry that you might be ordinarily used to see in poetry, I guess. And I think, on a more pragmatic level, I began to read over the last 2 or 3 years, more and more kind of formally experimental prose. And it made me more confident that there was a mode and an audience for prose and for novels that did have that, as I say, that maybe that attention to the kind of density of symbolic language as a primary concern.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because how did you feel knowing your novel has a sort of different shape to, let's say, a 300-page novel? It's a slimmer novel. Did you feel like, I mean, that I think there has been lately, we've seen more novels like that, novellas and things. But did you feel a slight apprehension? Because in some ways, the publishing industry can be quite rigid in terms of what it sees as a novel.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely felt a huge amount of apprehension, you know, full stop. I definitely knew that I'd created like a weird object on some level. And I know this is a kind of well-worn cliche, but I wrote the book because I wanted to read the book and the book didn't exist. It was exactly the book I wanted to read, and I looked for it and I couldn't find it. So I made it, and then absolutely had that feeling of, is there any avenue in which anyone else would care about this or accept it as, you know, as a novel? But that said, I think, and this is, I've got no evidence for this, it's just a feeling, but it does seem that, especially in the kind of more literary fiction end of the publishing industry, that there does seem to be a re-engagement with a kind of a sort of older mid-20th century tradition of, pliable prose, I guess. So, whether, as you say, that's the novella, or whether it's, things that are more formally experimental, there's been some fairly high profile successes, over the last sort of 5 years, Jenny Offal, Max Porter, those type of writers. And I think maybe in the way that commercial industries tend to work, once that model's proven, some of the drawbridges come down. I was absolutely prepared for people going, what the hell is this? but thankfully it didn't happen.
Was it met with enthusiasm straight away? Did you have an agent already before you had written Hourglass, or did you approach them with Hourglass? Was that how it happened?
I didn't have an agent prior to Hourglass. Poets, apart from a tiny, kind of minority at the sort of Carol Ann Duffy level, don't tend to, because, 10% of nothing is nothing. So, so people, it tends not to be worth anyone's while, really. But I did have, in the spirit of transparency, I'd had conversations with agents, and with my agent in particular previously, who had said, look, if you ever write anything that's not poetry, I'd be very interested to see it. What I did was, very kind of sheepishly, I sent this over to my agent and just said, look, I know you're not going to like this, not least because it's still sort of poetry. But I hoped that she might may have been able to direct me to another agent who might. She took it straight away and sold it relatively quickly. So I think it was, I got very lucky in that sense. And I think that's related to the form in a strange way, because it very much is, you either like it or you don't.
Yeah.
There was not much that could be done on a kind of pre-editorial level to make it something that it wasn't. I didn't have that period of adjustment with my working on the book with my agent. It just went straight out. There were no changes made at all, not a single change, not least because I built in this very, very clever mechanism where whenever someone asked for a change, I could say, well, it's got the same amount of words in every section, so you will ruin the symmetry completely.
How was that then for you to edit when you were paying such close attention to that kind of that rhythm and that pacing? How was that editing for you?
Luckily my editor, Anna Kelly, is phenomenal, just completely fantastic. I mean, truthfully, I would be really surprised if there were an identical amount of words now. I'm sure that
someone's going to go now and count every word just to prove you right or wrong.
I'm sure it's been lost along the way, but that's the spirit, at least. I suppose it does affect the editing process, because it makes it much more of a line edit process. We did kind of add at the later editorial stage, add more content about, for example, the mother character was smaller in the original draft, but I've written and edited another novel since, and it's been a wildly different experience, just because of it's much more formally traditional.
So would you say that the way you approached writing this novel was similar to the way you write a poem, or was the experience incredibly different?
It was quite different.
I suppose the sheer length of it was a complete new experience for you as well.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. On that front, that was different. And I mean, for me, different? They're related but different. So for me, a poem would be about taking an image or two images that seemed to suggest something to me, and going in and in and in and in, you know, trying to find the right architecture to hold this single image, you know, like this single moment or whatever it might be. Whereas writing Hourglass was very much like, where does that image take me? Where's the next one? Like, it was like following breadcrumbs almost. So it was kind of going outwards rather than, you know, it had a velocity of outwards rather than a velocity of inwards. So I'm sure actually from the outside, people would say, well, actually it was really similar, but emotionally it felt very different.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So was there anything you learned in the process of writing the novel? And I suppose it's taught you things for writing your next novel, but has it taught you anything for approaching poetry?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing this book taught me, and it's maybe the thing that's kind of unlocked my writing generally, is I held this very, in retrospect, silly and also sort of pretentious and also kind of banal idea of what kind of literary art looked like or sounded like. You know, and it's all of the cliches that, you know, you learn from a teenager onwards, you know, capital R romanticism and the doomed artist and the, you know, this kind of lifelong pursuit of kind of whatever it might be, like existential truth or you know, some grand concept. And I totally didn't understand that humor could be a route to that, and that actually part of my natural, whatever natural means in this context, but part of my natural inclinations as a writer were comedic. And I suppressed that massively in my earlier writing, like hugely, to the point of non-existence. And it was only when I allowed that to come out, the more conversational tone, you know, the kind of absurdity, let's say, that everything opened up. And it was also a route to all those other things that I wanted to do anyway. It was completely idiotic of me to not believe, you know, that comedy and a meaning could be, you know, bedfellows. And I broke through that, I think, with Hourglass. And I don't think I'll ever go back, you know, whether that's in poetry or, you know, or prose.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you say that I think maybe a lot of writers, when they're starting out, are trying to write in a specific way, kind of the way they feel like they should be writing. And like you say, how your writing comes from you is naturally more funny. And so it makes sense that if you're holding that back, you're preventing your kind of truth coming out when you're creating something.
Completely. And you're just distorting your voice as well, I think, you know, in the service of some ideal that is not well served by that suppression anyway. it's not as though as a reader or a you know, as someone or an interpreter of art, you know, whether that's like painting, literature, whatever it might be, music, that I don't appreciate wit. I really do. So why I thought that it was verboten in my own.
Maybe it goes back to that kind of thing of like the pretentiousness that you thought it had to be incredibly serious, and there wasn't room for that kind of humour.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you do. You draw a very, you know, shaky and under theorized parallel between humour and lack of substance. And the, you know, and those things just aren't, you know, just aren't the case at all, really.
And I've heard actually a lot of writers who write kind of more comedic work say that actually it's incredibly difficult to be funny on the page. So it is a different skill in itself.
I mean, it's certainly rarer, I think. You know, whether that's a function of what's published or whether it's a function of what's written, I don't know. But I can almost count the number of genuinely funny books, you know, I've read. And I don't mean in that way that, you know, people say, oh, Dickens is really funny. And then you read it and you're like, it's not really funny though, is it? You know, but, you know, books that have actually kind of made me laugh, you know, are quite sort of few and far between. And they also tend to be ones that have really, really moved me, because I think they, you know, even the type of laughter that comes when you're standing at the edge of a cliff and wondering whether to throw yourself off, it's still laughter. You know, like it's very rare that one goes through like anything truly dark or meaningful without it having some hilarity, you know, attached to it.
At least in retrospect,
you know, with a bit of critical distance. So.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about your kind of your wit in this novel, because I mean, even in your reading, the line about the gilets was fantastic. And I was just wondering, there's so many kind of little observations about the minutiae of life and all these kind of very specific details. Are you the kind of writer that is going around making these observations yourself and noting them down? Are they kind of all stored somewhere physically, or are they all just from your brain at the time of writing?
You know what, I'd really love to say that I'm the type of person who has like some sort of organized system or one of those elegant what do they used to call them in the Victorian, commonplace books, you know, where you would copy out all of your, you know, favorite quotations and observations. But I genuinely don't. I think it's more that I just find everything stupid, like on some deep fundamental level. I find like being alive quite absurd. So it tends to be just, I'll sit down and I want to write about X. And the more I think about it, the more X feels strange to me. And if you just keep pushing on the strangeness of something, its absurdity generally tends to reveal itself. So no, I don't keep a notebook or anything. I do sort of use Twitter in that way, actually, come to think of it, to just almost write things out and test if they're interesting or funny. I've never drawn a direct line between that and my writing, but maybe I sort of do use social media in that way. I've certainly been told my Twitter account's sort of bewildering to, you know, because it's sort of all over the place. So yeah, maybe actually I'm changing my mind in real time here.
Maybe Twitter's your notebook, possibly.
Yeah, maybe.
I wanted to go back a little bit to talk about the love story in the centre of the novel. And because of the style of your book, it's told in a very kind of fragmented way. And like you said, sometimes the time can be distorted. But as a reader, it's such a vivid and complete picture of a relationship. You really get a sense of their time together, even though we're only seeing little snippets here and there. How did you choose the moments you were going to show their connection and relationship to build this complete picture together? What was the kind of how did you choose which bits were going to be important or significant in their time together?
Well, I mean, firstly, I wrote a lot more than ended up in the book. So there was probably double the amount of content and, you know, and then you pare down to the most, you know, what strike you as the most essential things. In terms of that process, the thing that really became clear to me in writing, although I suppose I held this opinion theoretically anyway, is that the more specific the thing, the more universal the effect.
Mm.
And actually, I really tried to focus on that stuff, the stuff that felt like completely unusual or unique as an observation or as an action. Because I think that's actually what characterizes relationships. Like if people were to put a camera 24 hours a day on their own relationship and then show it to the outside world, I don't think anyone would get away without them thinking it was deeply strange. You know, they would use, you know, they'd have developed weird habits together. Yeah. They'd have developed weird language, almost an entirely separate language, in fact. You know, there would be strange backstories and metaphors, you know, all kinds of weird behaviors, let alone if you had access to the private things that each of the constituents of the relationship were doing. So I really thought that there was a choice to be made here of like, if I keep the really specific, really unusual, really striking things, my gamble was that they would register with people in a way that if I went for the universal, I think I would have ended up with a lot of people who quite liked the book.
Yeah.
And hardly anyone who loved it, you know. But I had that very teenage desire for people to really love it. I would much rather have half the readers, but have them really adore it, you know, to give it to people they love, you know, or, you know, you want the kid to like write something from it on their backpack or on their, you know, their school book, you know? So that was the gamble really, I think. And a lot of the stuff that came out, was removed from via editing, was the more generic stuff.
It's interesting.
I've never actually talked about this before, but you've got me thinking. Often there was something weird wrapped in something slightly more mundane. And what I tended to do was just remove all the mundane stuff until just the weird thing was left. And at first I thought, is this just going to be totally nonsensical? You know, is it just going to be a collection of kind of psychotic rambling? But it seems to, the logic of it seemed to hold together in a way that was fragile enough that I think it mirrors the sort of psychic fragility that one has when they're in love. You know, I thought there was something kind of spiderwebby about it, that sort of your brain can feel a bit like that, I think, when you're trying to maintain a connection with another entirely kind of separate human. Yeah, so that was such a rambly answer, but it was an interesting
question. No, it's a great answer, because I think, like you said, it's the universal theme, and yet to create that feeling, you have to be specific. And, you know, we've all had conversations with partners, friends, close people in our lives that would be bizarre to outsiders, but that makes that makes a relationship real. And when you've done that in Hourglass, that is what builds the picture. That's what makes your couple feel like they have existed. And that's really interesting you say that the things you removed were the universal things, even though that was the feeling you wanted to project into the book.
Yeah. Well, you kind of leave that as the lacuna, right? As the absence. And then the reader can sort of project the generic stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Onto it. I saw this really phenomenally interesting, to me at least, bit of data visualization once that seems relevant. I'm a real music nerd. So I saw this bit of data analysis that showed different genres of music and how many entirely specific words were used within it. And they showed if you had pop and rock in the middle, the vocabulary of the pop and rock canon was really quite limited, because it tended to be like, you know, love, you know, sadness, you crying, dancing, you know, these kind of, you know, quite generic things. But at either end of the scale on these complete outliers were hip hop and country and Western. which had vocabularies that were huge by comparison. And it was because they all used specific things.
Mm.
They would very rarely say, you know, I walked down the road. They would name the road. You know, they would very rarely say, like, I was drinking. They would name the bourbon or the, you know, or the wine. And I just, and I had something of that in mind as well, that you don't lose anything by being specific. No one's ever read a book and said, like, oh, no, I drink red wine, not white wine. There's no,
so this doesn't. I can't relate to this character. Yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What is your planning process like when you're writing? What was it like for this book? Because did you have in your head, I mean, I know one of the starting points was the hourglass itself and a love story. Did you have in your mind what kind of themes and ideas you wanted to write about before you started, or was that something that came as you were writing?
Yeah, I definitely had an idea, and there is that, you know, that idea that there's a central dilemma that you're trying to solve in a book or whatever, you know, and that's the lodestar, that's the thing you keep in mind. Well, I think for me it was how do you allow yourself to love what you love? You know, how do you allow yourself to love that you love, what you love? Mm. You know, like, how do you have an honest relationship to your own desire? Because I don't want to speak for everyone, but I just don't think we do. I think most of us are deeply alienated from our own desire. If someone were to ask me what I wanted, I don't think I could ever give a really good answer to that. So how do you love that you love what you love, I think, was the first thing. And the second thing was the ways in which love and being in love throw other parts of your life into relief, you know, and they make you realize the compromises you've made and the acceptances you've made in life, because they show you a kind of, they show you a sort of brighter horizon, right? They show you what being alive could be like, you know, if you hadn't made all of these compromises. So the question then is, when love ends, how do you honor the love? Like, the love's gone, right? But how do you honor the lessons it taught you? Like, how do you live more bravely, more boldly, you know, more honestly, even though the kind of source of it has gone? And there's a moment towards the end where the narrator describes love as being, you know, I want you to have the biggest, boldest, most beautiful life, brackets, but only if it includes me, close bracket. You know, and the question is like, how do you get rid of the brackets?
Mm.
You know, how do you look? How do you look at someone else and with and genuinely feel, you know, I love you, and because of that, I want you to have the biggest, boldest, bravest, freest, most beautiful life, whether it includes me or not. So those were the kind of questions I had in mind, and then I just let them kind of lead me, really. Mm. On a practical planning level, I just tried to, I would write one section at a time, essentially, on a sort of more mundane level. You know, each section, something like 700 words.
So I wanted to talk about your writing routine, really. What is a good writing day look like to you?
So I find it really difficult to write in snatches. You know, I really admire people who say like, oh, I just try and do an hour a day or 45 minutes a day. And I admire that because A, I find it impossible, and B, I'm sure that it's correct that, you know, kind of continuing to sharpen your pen, you know, in that way and to treat it as a practice is absolutely, you know, helpful. I'm just utterly useless at working in that way. So what I would tend to do is try and carve out chunks of time. So a few days at a time, you know, whether via annual leave or other things. And I would go, actually, my favorite thing to do is go to a hotel in a really terrible hotel in a city where I know no one and can't be sort of distracted. And just kind of write for two or three days straight, really. Because I think I do have a much more old fashioned and in some ways embarrassing, you know, relationship with ideas like inspiration or the muse or, you know, those type of things. I sometimes do, even if I don't believe them, actually, there is some part of me that kind of registers them as being true. And I have to be able to sit there for a long time and kind of let the good stuff come through. Longer term, I might need to develop some more practical techniques, because I'm not sure how viable that is over the long term.
What do you do on the days where you're really struggling, especially if you've booked off this time and you suddenly get to your really grotty hotel and you think, oh God, nothing's happening? What do you do then?
I tend to just write anyway. In a kind of free associative way. Luckily or unluckily, depending which way you look at it, I had a really big Yeats phase in my 20s. And so, and I've got a very esoteric mother. So the idea of kind of automatic writing is not something I find that strange. Mm. So I'm happy to just sit there and type and hope that at some point that the water stops being muddy and starts coming out clear or something like that. So I don't stress over it. I just type. Yeah, I move from writing to typing, I guess, is maybe the thing that I do.
So going back, where did your love of writing come from? Kind of, were you always writing even from a young age?
No, absolutely not. I didn't read a book till I was probably 15, 16. I mean, I'm sure I might have read one as a baby or something. But I wasn't a reader at all. I have one of those sort of predictable, but no more powerful for being predictable, stories of like a single individual teacher who, you know, basically decided that I should do something other than, you know, chase girls or whatever it was I was wasting my school time doing, and you know, gave me books. But prior to that, the thing I loved most of all was pop music. I was obsessed, like utterly, like deliriously obsessed with pop music, to the extent that I would kind of write out verbatim just all of the lyrics to all of the songs, you know, off the radio. I'd have like piles and piles of paper just full up with these, you know, words. So I had a sense that words could do something magical, I think, but it all came through song, not through books. And I still sort of think that, like, I still don't think there's ever been a book that's as good as like Be My Baby by the Ronettes, for example. You know, I mean, I've got undergraduate and postgraduate degrees in English literature,
but music's still better.
Yeah, it is really. I trade it all for, you know, to move that many people as powerfully and instinctively as a great song. So, words, yes, but books, no.
Right. Okay, that's really interesting. So when you're perhaps even when you're even though you write to get the words out, is it music you turn to more than books for inspiration or just to kind of get the creativity going?
I mean, I read a lot, you know, it's kind of, yeah, I read an awful lot, but I find it hard to read generically similar things when I'm writing. So if I'm going through a phase of writing something, I'll often read a lot of nonfiction, for example. I find having other fiction in my head unhelpful, both because it kind of bleeds in and blurs, but also I don't want to get into the game of, you know, comparison, you know, or anything like that. I do listen to a lot of music when I write, but I cannot listen to music with words. It will just completely, you know, distract.
I'm exactly the same, but it's amazing how many people do listen to music with words while they're writing. I can't do it. I don't know how people do it.
No, normally I'd end up just like, you know, the dialogue between the characters would just be the song, whatever song.
You'd end up doing a musical instead of what you were actually hoping to write.
Yeah, exactly. which is obviously the dream long term, but.
I know we've already talked about it and it is the worst question, but if you did have to make any comparisons between your book and others, who would you say your novel would appeal to, perhaps other books that you think it kind of shares the space with?
Yeah, that is a good question. And I really should find a good answer to it because every time people ask me, I kind of mumble and fluff the response. I mean, the one that keeps coming up, but I think it's possibly slightly superficial just because of the form, is Max Porter's Revisiting with Feathers, which is, you know, I'm very flattered by, but I think beyond the formal component, I'm not entirely convinced by. Maybe the Jenny Offal novels. Might be interesting if people like those. They were certainly helpful in making me realize that you could write in this kind of fragmentary form and still have, you know, a coherent heart or coherent whole. And then possibly, I'm just thinking of contemporary novels here rather than, you know, what I actually want to do is compare myself to the greats of the English literature. So Shakespeare aside, if you're a fan of Hamlet, then definitely read my book. But the other one maybe would be something maybe like Patricia Lockwood's most recent novel, like if that's the kind of humour you're into, then maybe you'd find something. You know, something in the book.
Yeah, that's a good shout, I think.
But yeah, my actual answer is Hamlet, Chloe.
Okay, Hamlet. If you're a Hamlet fan, this is the book for you. So thinking about other writers, you must have picked up a lot of kind of advice or learned a lot of things yourself. Can you give me your top three tips for any writers out there working on their first novel?
I would say your limitations are probably your strengths, so don't worry about them. It's way better to be really, really, really good at something than to break your back trying to fix all the things you're not great at, you know. So I think if you find that you're incredible at dialogue but really poor at plot, I have nothing against writing an entire book with no plot and all dialogue. you know, the space for all kinds of strangeness. So that I would say don't worry about what you think the market wants, what you think makes for a popular book. One, because culture is a complex machine and you can't predict it for a start. And secondly, you're on about a 4-year time lag. So by the time you actually get a book out, that'll be, you know, the industry will have already bought 15 books that are carbon copies of the last one that was a hit. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see it already. There's a Nirvana comes out and everyone loves it because it's amazing. And then people kind of like Pearl Jam, but like the publishing industry very quickly gets to just some random grunge band that kind of sounds a little bit like Nirvana and no one cares about anymore. Mm-hmm. So you really risk being at the tail end of a kickback if you try and time the market. So I would say that. And possibly, this is maybe a very arrogant thing to say, and it's definitely mileage may vary. I would say be wary of the type of consensus that comes from sharing your writing around and writers groups and creative writing courses and those kind of things. They can be absolutely amazing. I'm not criticizing them, but in my experience, they're incredibly good at producing polished 7 out of 10 books that no one hates. I just don't think the world needs any more of those. I just really don't. So I kind of, maybe like lean into your oddness, make your thing, put it out in the world, cross your fingers, hope for the best.
Yeah, that's a good bit of advice. And finally, I think we've touched on it already, but can you speak a bit about what you're writing next?
Sure, yeah. My next novel has been finished and sold already. So that's, I mean, that will take time to come out, I guess. It'll be 18 months or something or more, possibly. That's a much more formally conventional novel. It's a 5-perspective, rotating perspectives. And it focuses on essentially on working class male friendship and all of the things that go with that, including the kind of, you know, barely suppressed homoerotics of it, you know, the kind of crypto psychology of like male love, where, you know, instead of telling your friend you love them, you say, oh, you know, did you love track 3 on that album the same way I love track 3 on that album? And, you know, and when they say yes, what you're actually saying is I love you too, you know. But it's also, you know, it's also a novel about class and property in particular, you know, land, place. That speaks to my previous point. You probably couldn't think of a more unfashionable plot than that, you know, kind of five blokes moaning on.
Is that how it's going to be pitched? Your marketing tagline.
That's my working title. That's done and sold, you know, even a few other territories, so that's great. So I'm currently working on very, very speculatively another book that's may focus on the question of kind of long-term incestual relationships and, you know, all of the different complexities that arise from that. But I'll probably pause that one there because it needs some like working out before I talk about that publicly without, you know, being put in jail or lunatic asylum.
Oh, well, thanks so much, Kieran. I'm really looking forward to reading your next book, 5 Lads Moaning On, as it's now called. Thank you for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Chloe. I really appreciate it.
That was Kieran Goddard talking about his novel Hourglass, which is out now and available to buy. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you're subscribed already, please consider leaving a review. See you next time. Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.